this one for the homemakers. Hey, this one for the homemakers. Hey, hey, dancing through a homemaker. Hey, hey, this one for the homemakers. This one.
Hey y'all, welcome to Patriarchy Country, where we are throwing back the curtain on what life is like when you're a member of the Patriarchal Wives Club. Today I'm joined by Potluck Lauren, and we're going to be talking about her journey from woke to reformed queen mom. So join us.
Hello. I'm so excited to be here. I'm
glad for you to be here. Okay, this is a disaster already. I love it.
This is my daily life. It's like this. So it's fine. It's perfect.
Listen, this is Patriarchy Country. It is not perfect here. So, Lauren, tell us, were you severely mentally retarded or possessed by a demon when you were woke?
Definitely severely mentally retarded. I look back on that time in my life and I'm just like, sometimes I'm like, what an idiot. I mean, I know that I had people in my life that would tell me like, Lauren, you need to just shut up. But it wasn't enough. Like, I wish I'd had more of someone to be like, this is the reason why you need to shut up. But definitely there was something mentally going on there for sure. And I look back on it and think like, thank God for God's grace. But it's a humbling.
Okay. And how old are you? So what, give us a time frame of like your life.
I am 33. I'm about to be 34 next month. And I would say probably, you know, it's hard to pinpoint an exact time that I started being like woke, I guess. But I grew up in a Southern Baptist home. My parents are pretty conservative, at least politically. And grew up going to public schools probably about the time that I became like later on in my teenage years, so probably about 17 to, let's see, I first started noticing a change in everything probably after the birth of my first child, so around 27 28, and which we can kind of get into a little bit more of the story later, but it was because of something, several kind of things that were really tragic that happened in my personal life and with my family, that kind of God just used to bring.
It do be like that sometimes. How woke were you though? Were you like raging blue-haired feminist, or were you kind of like toe in the water woke? Like, how? Give me like a spectrum.
Yeah. You know, at the time, I would not have said I was woke. I would have said that I was just like reasonable. And, you know, I look back on like Facebook statuses, like your Facebook memories. Oh my gosh. Like, God uses that to humble me every day. And I've started like deleting some of them because they're so bad. But, just, I wasn't like a blue, I never dyed my hair blue. Thank the Lord. But I was very like, you know, women make less money than men. We have more problems than men. I never wanted to be like a women preacher or anything. And I didn't like women preachers, but I was very like, I want to go to seminary. Like Brad went to seminary. I want to go to seminary. I want to get my master's in theology, you know, my MDiv or whatever. I even at one point we had moved to Utah to, work under the North American Mission Board. And while we were there, either one of us could have gone to Golden Gate Seminary, for furthering education. And I was seriously considering doing that, trying to get my PhD for free, because we could have been able to do it for free while we were there. And I can just remember talking to my dad about it. And I was like, yeah, I can do this for free. I want to get my PhD. And my dad was like, Lauren, why? And I can just remember like talking to him and I was thinking, well, because I want to be able to say I have a PhD. Like, I'm a woman, and like, how much better that will be, like that I can say I have a PhD and theology or, you know, or whatever I chose to pursue. And he was just like, that's kind of not a great reason to choose that. So probably more of a toe in the water thing. I was very vocal about like racial issues as well. And really when I look back on it now, I can see that it was very, it was a lot of virtue signaling. I wanted people to look at me and say, oh, well, she's not racist. When the reality is it was all selfish. Like, it doesn't matter if I was racist or not racist. I wanted people to look at me and think I was good. So just a lot of virtue signaling.
I got you. I am fascinated by woke white people. Just because I grew up with kind of like a much different background than a lot of the like our mutuals on Twitter and stuff. And I hear this a lot from people. Like, I don't know, Homemaker Megs, she's talked about how she used to be like crazy woke. And it's hard to imagine y'all that way, but I also find it so fascinating because I don't know, never in my life did it ever occur to me that people would like perceive me as racist, even though I'm sure there are people who do, but I just find the whole thing to be extremely fascinating. But thank goodness you had a good daddy and God brought you out of it. And where, okay, so you and Brad are married, you're woke. Was he like, oh my gosh, my wife is so embarrassing? Or he was kind of on the train with you?
I think for the most part, I think that there definitely were times where he was like, my wife is so embarrassing. Brad is he's very quiet. He's the opposite of me. He doesn't speak quickly. He's not hasty to respond to things. And just everything about him is very like slow to react, slow to anger, slow, you know, which is a great thing. You know, he's very gentle minded. And when he gets angry, there's been a lot of calls to be angry. You know, there were times where I think that he was kind of like on the fence about stuff, but also like that was when we were both younger. He's about 4 years older than me, but when we first got married, you know, I just was so, I didn't want to cook. I didn't want to be a housewife. I mean, I thought about like, if you were a housewife or a mom, I just thought that that was like the most degrading thing possible. And I can remember being in an argument with him one time. I don't even know what it was about, but I was just like, Brad, like, I don't want to be like, I've never wanted to be a housewife. I don't want to be this. I'm made for more. You know, I'm smart and like, I want to be able to do these other things. And like, basically was just like telling, like blaming him for keeping me down in some areas. And at one point, like he was like, Lauren, like I've never kept you from doing anything that you wanted to do. And he's like, I've never tried to put you down. I've never done any of these things you are accusing me of. And I can just remember in the argument, I was thinking to myself, he's right. Like, he's never tried to say, you know, like, just push me down or like be oppressive or anything. But I was like, I was putting that on him. I was like saying, this is what is happening when it wasn't really happening. And you know, those were like, that was like tiny moments of like glimpses of, you're very unreasonable, Lauren, and you need to change. Unfortunately, I didn't change then. But I look back on that now and I see, you know, so much of his grace, so much of him leading me toward a better option and toward a better understanding of what scripture says about women and their role as wives and mothers. And you know, if they're not a wife or a mother, let they have other things that are glorious and God glorifying. And so he was, I can see him leading me gently in that direction. But I think that he also knew that like it's not something that I was very, very headstrong. I mean, I still am, but he knew that it wasn't going to be just immediate, that I was going to change. So definitely him like very slowly leading me in the right.
Awesome. Praise God that you caught your head and that you absolutely have a patient husband. And I feel like as women, we're kind of prone to the sort of like, I feel like we're prone to covetousness a bit, and then also a bit prone to the blame game, which I think is in general kind of people. We'd always like to believe that it's not us, it's someone else. But I find myself sometimes as a wife realizing like that I'm doing that with my husband and stopping myself. And it's just occurred to me, I hear a lot of other wives do it, and it's like, yeah, this is actually something that like I think women struggle with in a different way than men do.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, for me specifically, and for a lot of women that I see, like we are prisoners to our own emotions a lot of times. And for someone like Brad, and like, I think most men are more even killed in a lot of their emotions, unless, you know, I think some men struggle with anger maybe, but Brad has never been like that. And so he's very reasonable. He can look at the facts and say, you know, these are the facts, this is the data. Whereas I would look at the facts and be like, well, that hurts my feelings, which I think is also a very woke mindset of, you know, your feelings trump facts, when that's just not the case. And you have to be able to look at something and say, you know, my feelings are not telling me good things about this, but I still need to accept it as
I have noticed that. I'm sure that's why Ben Shapiro got his little like facts don't care about your feelings kind of, you know, motto. But in talking to like woke people, they'll talk about, so I grew up in a neighborhood that's, you know, we were well below the poverty line. And, you know, everyone around us was on government assistance. Everyone around us was, you know, also very well below the poverty line. And I will talk to people and they'll say, well, they would be able to dig themselves out of that if not for this and that. And to be clear, there 100% are kind of roadblocks that contribute to making that harder when you're poor. But some of the things, you know, they'll say these, and I'm just like, okay, no, like I lived in these neighborhoods. You know, the idea that financial responsibility doesn't contribute to, or financial irresponsibility really doesn't contribute to people's financial issues when they're, you know, below the poverty line. It's like, no, walk down the neighborhood, walk down the street. There, the side of the street is littered with lottery tickets, cigar wrappers, cigarette boxes, beer cans. I'm not saying that it's wrong for them to buy any of those things per se, but none of that is food or necessities. And so obviously this contributes to, you know, the issues that are there, the fact that, you know, these things are so popular. And when you say that, people are like, that's so racist, that's so classist. And it's like, I live there. I live there. I know these people. I care for these people. Like, these are people in my life. You can't just deny the reality of the fact that, you know, financial irresponsibility contributes to some of the problems just because it doesn't sound nice.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, for me specifically, there were just so many times where, I mean, again, I remember having an argument with my husband about women's wages, and like, I think he said something about, we were listening to some radio station that they were talking about the wage gap and all this. And Brad made some comment like, the wage gap doesn't exist. And I just looked at him like, are you insane? Like, of course it exists. And of course we get into this fight about like whether women are getting paid as much as men and whatever else. And so, but I look back on that now and I just think like, that's just not like, first of all, that doesn't matter. And secondly, a lot of what he was saying was true. And I just wasn't ready to face the music because the wage gap myth fed into my emotions.
Right. Yeah. the emotional appeal of like women make less. The wage gap always makes me laugh because it's like, okay, well, why do any companies ever hire men then if they can pay women less? That I don't understand.
Right.
And when you try and explain to people why it's like silly, they don't want to accept that either. You know, they'll say, well, why are women drawn to these? It's like careers that pay less. And it's like, I don't know. You'll have to ask God. But even when you look at, you know, the numbers from Sweden, Norway, you know, these countries are considered the most egalitarian in the world. You've got about 30% of women who are drawn to like the techie jobs. And otherwise, it's, you know, it's still mostly like the more social jobs that do tend to pay less.
Right. Yep.
It is funny. So you had the pay gap. That was very upsetting for you. Now, were you working or you were at home?
Yes, I have pretty much been working since I was about 15 years old. My parents were, you know, the normal middle class, maybe a little bit above middle class. I'm not really sure. We never went without anything. We were, you know, I grew up in the South. And so you grow normally, if you're in the South, you grow up in church as well. And I grew up in an SVC church. And, but of course, at 15, as soon as you're ready to be driving, if you want to buy a car, my parents are like, you got to get a job. Which is something that I differ with them on now, which, you know, when I was growing up, I was thinking like, this is what I'm going to do for my kids. Like, this is what they need to do. But I definitely have a different, viewpoint on that now. And so I've been working since I was about 15. When we got married, I was like a tech for an ophthalmologist's office. And then I was going to school to get my master's in education, which is a joke, by the way. And then I started teaching, and I taught in public school at a Title I school for 3 years. And that third year I became pregnant with my first son. And I think that was kind of like the beginning of me realizing I want to be home with my.
Can confirm, I also have a master's in education. It is a joke. I always tell people on Twitter that, like, there's absolutely nothing that makes me more qualified to teach your kid than you. This was a silly waste of time. Not exactly, but I got my master's for a reason. Donnie wanted me to get it, but it is very silly. So walk us through, you had your son, you know, got pregnant, had your son, and you're going through this like mental journey of realizing that, you know, your kind of view of the world through all this whole like woke stuff is maybe not exactly accurate.
So let me back up just a little bit. So when we first met, I was in school. I was getting my undergrad in theology. It was a biblical studies degree from a private Baptist college here in Mississippi. And I got done with it. I, you know, aced all of my classes and was really good, especially in the biblical languages classes. And I had many professors that approached me and were like, are you planning to go to RTS? Which there, we have a Reformed Theological Seminary here in Jackson. And so I wanted to do that, but I also knew me and Brad were planning to get married. And so I wasn't sure like how that would play out at that point. I knew I was probably going to have to just get a job right off the bat. Cause when we first got married, we were very poor. which was also a shock to me, like going from a family that never did without to now you're paying for everything on your own. And you're also not making very much cause you're just starting out on, something like a new job. And, anyway, so when we first got married, we both felt like Brad was being called to seminary. He felt called to preach. And so we were like, you've got to go to seminary. So he starts going to RTS. And while he's there, I had so much jealousy, so much envy for him being there because I wanted to be there so badly. And it wasn't that I wanted to be there because, excuse me, because I felt the Lord wanted me there. It was, I wanted people to know that I was smart and that I had a theology degree as well. And, you know, I can remember when we would be, you know, out with friends, or if we'd go out to eat with Brad's parents and some of their friends or something, they would always be like, so Brad, like, you know, tell me what this passage means, or like, what are you learning in your Hebrew classes and that kind of stuff. And I can just remember sitting there just boiling and thinking, I've done those classes too. Like, I could answer this question too. Why don't they ask me? Which is just so selfish and silly. I look back on that now and I think, like, who cares? Like, I'm so glad that, yeah, it is really hilarious. Like, I'm so glad that I can look back and think, now I hope that they ask Brad, because I want him to answer. Don't ask me, which I've been out of school for that kind of thing for a long time. So definitely don't ask me. But like, how silly and like childish and immature that whole thing was. So like, while he was doing that, I was working pretty much. He was working some too, but because of his school workload, he couldn't work full time until the very end, when he started being a hospice chaplain. And so I was working, and I also had a lot of contempt for that. You know, just thinking like, I'm the one working, I'm having to do all this, which again goes back to like, and I'm not saying that everything that Brad did and made a decision for was right, but I definitely had a wrong attitude about everything. And I wanted to be known for my own stuff, but I also didn't want to work, and I didn't want to put him through. I didn't want to have that responsibility, which was, you know.
Honestly, it is funny. I don't know. I'm just thinking about, like, I have no doubt that your husband probably elevates you in the sense of saying, like, you know, Lauren worked while I was in seminary and put me through. Like, that's a thing that you definitely should be like elevated for, right?
Yeah. And I mean, the thing is like, when I think about it now, I can remember clear instances where Brad would even say, like, when people would ask him about theology stuff, like, he would say, I don't know, like, you might want to ask Lauren about that. She did better in that those kind of classes than I did. But I would just see red, you know, whenever people would come to him first, knowing that I had a theology degree too, which was, again, very childish, very immature. And nobody needs to come, like, nobody needs to be asking me any theological questions if that's going to be my mindset about all of it. But yeah, I mean, there were plenty of times where he was like, Lauren is great at, you know, X, Y, Z. And I just brushed over it because I wanted to be great at everything. I wanted it to be better than.
Oof. I think we've all had that moment. I was definitely like the golden child growing up. So I've had moments with friends and stuff where it was like, why isn't everyone paying attention to me? And I look back and I'm like, oh my gosh, that was so cringe and like immature and ridiculous. Thank God I've moved past that now. But okay, so he goes to seminary, you're working, you're like boiling with rage because anyone ever gives him any attention over you. And what, if, like, lead us through the rest of the story.
Okay, so yes, I was boiling with rage. So funny. So I was teaching, and then in my last year teaching, I got pregnant. We both decided that I wanted to be able to stay home with my son. And right towards the, like, that whole last year of me teaching, Brad wanted to do church planting. We started the process through the North American Mission Board to get signed up for that. And it was a pretty long, heavy process of just being vetted, going to interviews and all this kind of stuff. And so by the end of me teaching, we knew I was going to stop teaching. I was going to be staying home, and we were going to move to Utah. We moved to West Valley City, Utah. And we were there for about 3 years. Now, the first year we were there, right after I had my son, it was at the end of that school year. I had him in June, and Brad gave me a camera because I had mentioned wanting to learn how to do photography. Brad had a cousin who had taught herself how to do photography. And I was like, look, if she can teach herself, like I can teach myself too. So I started learning how to do photography. At the moment, it was just so I could take good pictures of my son. And then eventually evolved into a business where I now do wedding photography, and I'm able to stay at home with my kids. But at the time, so it was about a year and a half in to this process. We've moved to Utah, and I was going to be coming home for a wedding in Mississippi. So a friend of mine was getting married. She wanted me to shoot her wedding. They paid for us to come back. And it was just enough. At the time, I wasn't making a whole lot doing wedding photography, but it was enough for me and Brad and my oldest son to come back to Mississippi. We were excited to be able to come back and see family and everything. Well, while I was here in Mississippi, we got a phone call that my brother was in the ICU. And he had been shot 3 times at point blank range. Two of the gunshots, two of the bullets grazed his arm, and then one had lodged into his spine. And he was in the ICU. We weren't sure if he was going to make it. We knew that he was possibly paralyzed from the waist down. He had been on hard drugs since he was about 17. And I'm trying to remember how old I was at this point. Had to have been 28. I think, or 29. I can't really remember. I think 28. So he gets shot. We go, while we were there, like, thank God we were there. I just look at that and I think, like, that was God's providence all over that. So we get to the ICU. He ends up making a pretty much a full recovery. He is paralyzed from the waist down. But during that time, and after that, for a little while, there was a lot of turmoil in my family, a lot of, like with my parents and my brother and my sisters. And he was not in his right mindset. I think I do definitely believe like he's under some sort of like, demonic possession in a sense. Not that that negates any of his sin, but, I thought for sure being at rock bottom, while he was in the hospital, he would repent and turn back to Christ. Because he had grown up in church as well, and he did not do that. And during that time, I just fell into a very deep depression. Lots of despair over that whole situation and just other things that were going on. We lived in Utah. We were really far away from family. It was just really, really hard. And I just remember, you know, that looking back on it now, I thought I was in this deep pit with no one. And I just started reading the Bible. And I think that God placed me in that pit specifically. I don't think people ever talk about depression as being something that God uses for his glory. But I think that God put me into that pit. He brought the depression upon me so that I would know that I had nowhere else to go. So I just started reading my Bible, sometimes 5, 6, 7 times in a day. It was like all I did. And God just like lifted this, this veil over my eyes that had been there. And I can just remember being so distraught and broken over the sin that I had committed against my husband, the sin I had committed against my parents, against other people. And just being really, really broken over that. And just praying, like, I don't know, like, God, I don't know how you can forgive me for the things that I've done. I had had a past of just a lot of sin, pornography use, just sexual sin in my past. And just thinking, like, you know, like, I don't know how, and of course, like, just the disrespect and dishonor that I had for my husband and my marriage. And I can just remember coming to Brad and being like, how can you ever forgive me? And like the grace and mercy in his eyes was like, he was like, I've just been waiting for you. You know, like it was no thought whether he would forgive me or not. It just like immediately was there. And so like that kind of started the journey of me like coming up out of that pit of depression and despair and like realizing I have sinned against a holy God. And so I don't know if that was a conversion experience, because I would say that I did believe in God and I did have faith. Like, again, I grew up in an SBC church, which that doesn't mean anything, but like, I knew who God was. I did believe that he was real. I did believe that Jesus was real and lived and died and resurrected. But I don't know that I ever had like that faith of like, you can forgive me, God, like you've done this to forgive me. So maybe it was a conversion experience. I don't know. It wasn't like one specific moment or day, but it was definitely over a long period, like months, maybe like a year or two of like him bringing me to this.
That's amazing. And what a king your husband is. I love that, that he
absolute king. Like, yes.
Yeah. He was just like, yeah, no, of course I forgive you, but stop being ridiculous.
Yeah, exactly.
That's pretty much what Tony tells me whenever I'm being crazy. He's like, yes, no, I forgive you, but can you like not, like, let's just not do this anymore. I love that. And God is so good. He is so faithful to, you know, bring us out of the depths of our own mental retardation when it comes to, you know, these kind of sins that we oftentimes I feel like when it's a sin of the heart, you don't even realize that that's what you're doing until you have that kind of like aha moment. And then it's almost like one of those movie scenes where they're, you know, like the past just comes rushing back in all these like clip scenes. And you realize like all of the times that you have engaged in this sin as if it was just like casual.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say also, you know, in the beginning it was, you know, God brought me low. He brought me to the end of myself on just like being really selfish and prideful. And that was like the first sin he's worked on. And as soon as those barriers were down, not saying I never struggle with pride, because I definitely do. But like, once those barriers were down, it was amazing how like every so often he would bring up something else in my life that I needed to squash. And, you know, whether it was, right after that, I can remember, you know, the way I talked about my parents, the way I, interacted with my parents. And that's something that still, God is working with me on. But definitely he would bring those things up to me to say like, okay, like now we're working on this, you know, now you need to repent of these things. You need to work on this part. And so it was like, you know, not all at once was I just perfect or doing everything great. But he would definitely bring up something, especially once I'd think like, okay, you know, now like I'm forgiven and I'm pretty clean now. He'd be like, oh, you've got a couple more things we got to talk.
Right. You're like, all right, I'm doing pretty well. And God's like, LOL.
Exactly.
Oh, but he is so amazing. I do want to just go off a little off topic here for like a second. You said that you grew up in an SBC church. I did as well. I recorded an episode already about purity culture, and I don't want to go into all of that stuff, but I did find out that the person who made the True Love Waits campaign, his official job title was youth ministry consultant. Would you call that aggressively SBC? Because that was like my first thought whenever I read that. Like, this is an aggressively Southern Baptist job.
Yeah, probably. I definitely think that the SBC has like, you know, they're very like, we have the head pastor and then you have the youth minister and like that kind of thing. I definitely have some thoughts about the SBC. I don't know how much time you have or want to talk about some of those things.
Oh,
but,
girl, I've got time. You can, like, go off. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, basically, to be frank, when we were working under the North American Mission Board in Utah, we just started realizing it was right around the time I was, like, God was bringing me out of, you know, my delusion. And we started realizing there was a lot of corruption going on with NAM. And, you know, and just the SBC in general. And I'm not saying everyone that's in leadership is corrupt or evil or anything like that, but we do have some problems in the SBC that really need to be addressed. And, you know, with NAM, they've got, they're up and I think they're down in baptisms, like 50% down in church plants, 50%, something crazy. And then their assets are up over $400 million. And so, you know, when people are giving to the Annie Armstrong or Lottie Moon offerings or whatever that say they go, all that money goes specifically to missions. Is it, like, I'm wondering, is it going to missions? Is it going to a family who's church planning? Is it going to a pastor or a church? Because they've started buying up all this real estate in different, they call them send cities, like S-E-N-D. And they're like different cities all over the U.S. that they would say, oh, we need, you know, church planters here. And then another thing that was really, that bothered Brad a lot while we were there is that they would have churches come under the umbrella of NAM and say they were a church plant, but they weren't Baptist and they weren't a church plant. They were already established churches that they could say, oh, this is under the umbrella of NAM, so they could count them among their church plants. And then the people that would, because Brad had a conversation with a pastor one time that was supposedly a NAM plant, and he was like, oh yeah, I'm not Baptist, but I am when I need to be. So like, that's an issue because people are giving their hard earned money to this and tithing, and they're being told this money is going to go towards, you know, XYZ, and it's not. It's going to buy real estate. It's going to line pockets, and it's going to fund church plants that aren't Southern Baptists. Like, that's a big.
Yeah, I would say that it is. We are not Southern Baptists anymore. But it sounds like are you guys still Southern Baptists?
Yes, or? Brad is a pastor at a Southern Baptist church in Mississippi now.
Okay. I've heard other people talk about some of these things, maybe not exactly this stuff. I try to keep the SBC is very like close to my heart because I wasn't raised in a Christian home, but I was raised in church. I had an aunt and uncle that would always take us, and the people there, although many of them have gone kind of oddly woke, it's a little weird, they were really instrumental in my upbringing, in helping me like really understand the Lord, and, you know, very much a big part of who I am today. So I kind of keep up with like the SBC drama, but it's been a lot lately, like just a total disaster with like, you know, Rick Warren got, I guess, kicked out, essentially, because yes. He was like ordaining women.
Yes. Even though he's preached to millions and millions of people.
Well, I saw this video of Doug Wilson, like watching Rick Warren's like, you know, statement about ordaining women. And he was like, culture didn't change my mind. And Doug Wilson just kind of like looked at the camera and like laughed. It was pretty funny. But it's all very interesting to see. I wonder if, you know, perhaps, I just wonder what's behind all of it. I don't know. I won't speculate because I probably don't know enough about it, but it does seem like the ordaining of women seems to be behind at least some of the pushes. Like, that's where they want to end up.
Yeah, so there were church plants in Utah specifically that we knew about that were under the umbrella of NAM who had women preachers. And they can say all day long that they don't support that, that they don't do that. But the thing is that it is happening, and it is, you know, these people should be coming under authority that would say, no, you cannot be a part of NAM. You cannot be a part of the SBC if you have a women preacher. But what they've been doing so far is saying, oh no, like, you guys are so, you're an alarmist. You are worried about things that aren't happening. And they're going to keep saying that and keep saying that until like all of a sudden it is happening. And then they're like, well, there's nothing we can do. And then we need to celebrate this. Like, it's just constant gaslighting along the way. And that's something that's going on right now, especially with people like Bart Barber, who's the president right now. And he is just very, he'll say that he's anti-abortion, but clearly goes against things that are trying to get rid of abortion, like trying to bring in laws and bills and stuff like that that can get rid of abortion. And again, it's gaslighting. Like he'll say, I'm not pro-abortion, I'm not pro-abortion. And then at the end of the day, he's going against bills that are trying to get rid of that in certain.
Yeah, they tanked that bill in Louisiana. That was actually
gonna, yeah, that's the one I'm thinking of right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wouldn't. Yeah, that was pretty disappointing for us. 100%.
Disappointing is a word, is like the most lukewarm word I could think of. Disdainful is better.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. I'm trying. Yeah, it was pretty awful. I was appalled that they would do that, and you know, personally, we fall on the side of why wouldn't you prosecute the mother? But
yes, you know, me
I know
too.
People have a lot of points to be on that. I figure we probably lined up. It's interesting that you, you know, you say like, okay, they're going to deny it until they can't. And then they're going to be like, oh, well, we need to celebrate it. Cause that's essentially what the left does. That's what the woke people do with a lot of things. You know, they'll say like the gender surgeries for kids is one of the most recent examples. For, you know, over a year now, they've been saying that doesn't happen. Now they're saying, so what if it happens? You know, the next step is, well, it's good actually that it's happening.
Yes.
You know, and exactly. I've definitely, it's obvious that the church has been infiltrated by like a lot of woke ideology kind of just across the board. I can tell by just, you know, if you put something that's just like fully biblical and not even like doesn't seem controversial, you just post it on Twitter and there'll be so many people in the replies who are like, well, but what if, and like nuance, they want you to asterisk everything.
Yeah, the qualifiers kill me. They kill me.
Yeah, same. And so it's the wokeness infiltration is kind of obvious, but it's interesting that just that you said that, because it's like, okay, no, they actually are following like the same playbook. Basically.
Yes. And I would even say like I think that it's easy for me to recognize, because when I was woke, I would I can remember, even I've always been against abortion, but at a point I can remember talking to friends and being like, well, you know, if someone's raped, like I don't know, like I can't tell them what to do in that situation. That would just be a really hard situation. Or like if I was raped, you know, God forbid, I don't know what I would do in that situation. And so it had definitely, it infiltrates that way of like, here, what about this outlying exception? When the fact is that abortion because of rape is like less than 1% of abortion. So we can't bring that into the foreground and say, well, we've got to make the law wide sweeping to cover this less than 1% of abortions that's happening. The majority of abortions that are happening are because people want to be able to excuse their sin and have sex whenever they want, and they don't want to have to deal with it.
Yeah, I read a tweet from Summer Yeager from Sheologians the other day, and she was talking about transhumanism and how if we don't understand that women on birth control are already engaged in like, yep, transhumanist, yep, like behavior, that we don't understand transhumanism. And it honestly, I've been anti-birth control, anti-abortion, everything, but that, like, I'm still processing, because it has literally changed my entire view of everything.
Yes. Absolutely.
I even commented underneath. I was like, I don't understand. Where can I find more? Because I'm so like, this has blown me away. But it is, yeah. The push is always to separate us from the consequences of our actions. And that's, you know, a real like tool that Satan uses to kind of, you know, trick us into believing that we don't need, you know, don't need to worry about what we're doing, that we're fine. You know, if you don't have the negative consequences, if you, you know, are having promiscuous sex and you have a baby that you have to take care of, I don't mean it in a negative way, but the baby is going to always be a reminder to you that, like, hey, my consequences actually have my decisions actually have consequences. If you can just wipe away the consequences and pretend like the actions never happened, how do you ever learn to control yourself, to make good decisions?
Yeah. And one thing that I think that, especially for my generation, because I've seen it with my parents and I've seen it with other people in our generation, with their parents growing up, it was, you know, don't have sex before you're married because you could get an STD or you could get pregnant. And when we approach our children, teaching them about like what a biblical sex ethic is, and we try to convince them, like, don't have sex before you're married because you could get a disease or pregnant, like, you're basically equating babies with STDs. Like, you're saying this is a bad thing. And so now we wonder why our generation is so anti-baby. I think it's a mixture of a lot of things, but I definitely also believe that some of it goes back to that. We have in our minds that if you get pregnant, it's the worst possible thing that can happen to you, just like getting AIDS or something. And we should never have that mindset as Christians. We should never, now we don't want our children to be pregnant before they're ready, before they're married and they have, you know, both a father and a mother there to be able to support that child with love and also financially and everything. But at the same time, like, what if we approached our children now this way of, we shouldn't have sex before we're married because the Lord has decreed us not to. He has said it is not good. This is a sin against a holy God, you know, and sex is such a good thing when it is used within the confines of marriage. And everything that you do before marriage, any sexual partner or activity that you engage in before marriage, it will absolutely carry over into negative consequences into your marriage later on, no matter what anyone says. It doesn't matter if you don't have an STD. It doesn't matter if you never got pregnant. You will have those mental blocks in your head for the rest of your marriage, whether it's your husband that engaged in it or you're the ones that you engaged in it as the wife. That is going to be something that you're constantly thinking about and constantly, is there. You know, God created a man and a woman to be together in a covenant for life. And, it's just hard to, it's hard to reconcile that with our society and our culture now that is so pro do whatever you want, do whatever feels good. There's no consequences. If people say there's consequences, they're just jealous. They don't want you to have fun, that kind of thing. Like, that's a lie from Satan. And I definitely want my children to grow up being told, like, sex is such a great, wonderful gift from the Lord. But it is only a great, wonderful gift from the Lord when it is used within marriage. When it is used outside of marriage, it is a perverted, corrupted thing that will defy.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the push right now is, well, and it has been for a while, that what you do doesn't affect anyone else. And I, as yes. someone who, so I was, you know, I was pure when I got married. You know, Tony's the only man that I've ever kissed, even. He had a child at 15. So, I mean, he had like a very wild before Christ life. And a lot of sexual partners, and that did affect me. It is something that we definitely have worked through at this point, but for a while I had a lot of questions of, you know, am I as good at this as this other person? Would he rather be doing this with that other woman that he did it with before me? And like I said, we were able to easily work it out. Eventually it was something that I just got upset about and brought up, and he was like, I would have married her if that was the point, if that was the case, like, you're dumb. But it did, you know, it affected me for a while. It made me self-conscious about our sex life.
Yeah.
And
yes.
So it's just important to keep in mind that, you know, when you become married, you are two becoming one. So the things you do before that happens, it is going to affect your literal other half.
And also just thinking about like the freedom that comes with, you know, people want to look at God's law and say, oh, this is chains. These are shackles around me. I can't do anything fun, blah, blah, blah. When the reality is that it's freedom. You know, if I had not engaged in some of the things that I had engaged in before marriage, and Brad had not engaged in some of those things before marriage, like how much more freedom in my mind, especially for me, like I think that it is especially hard for women to overcome some of those mental obstacles. But how much more freedom would be in our marriage because of that, you know, knowing that I never had to think that he's thinking about somebody else, you know, not that he is, and, you know, hopefully he's not, but at the same time, like, that would never even cross my mind. There is freedom in the truth and in a true standard. There's freedom in what God has for us, and the world will say, no, that's not freedom. Those are chains, you know, do whatever you want. When in reality, again, that's a lie from the devil. Like that's a lie from the pit of hell. Just like in the garden, when the serpent tempts Eve and says, you know, did God really say, like, what happened to them? Did they have freedom after that? Of course.
Yeah. One of the weirdest things that I think people say whenever we're talking about purity before marriage is, well, you have to test drive the car before you know if you want to buy it. And it's like, yeah, I'm not a
nonsense
car.
Yes, like, absolutely.
I'm not a car. I'm not an object. It's like nonsense. And how did this pick up as like something that's viewed as a legitimate argument?
Yeah, it's really terrible. And you know, I know that I'm not perfect, and I'm not saying that when I raise my children up, they're going to be perfect. And I do hope and pray that the Lord blesses them and keeps them and convicts them of sin or keeps them from temptation. But again, just going back to like, I want to teach my children a biblical sex ethic. I want them to know that babies are not an STD. Like it's not some disease and parasite that grows on you. But that it is a wonderful blessing from the Lord. And that's what scripture says about children. And when you go outside the confines of what God has created, the perimeters that God has created for having a child and for sexual activity, then that's when you get into things that harm you, and not just harm you, but harm others. Like you said, the thing nowadays is, well, if they're not hurting you, like, why do you care? The thing is that you are hurting others. You are contributing to the downgrade of society. Like whether you think it or not, you are. And your consequences, your actions don't just have consequences for you. They have consequences for everyone. Think about a teen who goes and has sex before they're married and they get pregnant. That consequence is, you know, having a baby is far reaching to not just them, but to the person they had sex with, to their parents, to the other set of parents, to siblings of that child. You know, that is something that is far reaching. And we don't like to think of things that way because we want to say, well, I can do whatever I want to do and people can just, you know, shove off, which is just not true and is not what the Bible.
Well, and I think it's really, you know, the whole like babies are, you know, you might get pregnant kind of fear factor of trying to push sexual purity, in how that has really kind of warped people's views of children and of the consequences of sexual impurity. You know, it just kind of shows like when we get away from God's commands and teaching them, like the number one reason why you should be sexually pure is because that's what God wants you to do.
Absolutely.
That's what he's said. You know, and all of these other reasons, yeah, like you don't want to have a baby at 16. You don't want to end up with an STD, but you may not get any of those things. And what you're doing is still not right.
And Jesus says, you know? If you love me, you will obey my commandments. And so many people, you know, if you bring that up, they'll say that's works based and that's legalism, blah, 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 which, it, you know, whatever. I don't listen to people like that because, yes, you are justified by faith. But God has set works for us to do. He has prepared good works for us to walk in, and we should love to follow and obey the Lord. You know, when I tell my children to obey, I ask them to obey because they love me. I ask them, do you love me? And of course, their answer is, yes, we love you. Then you will obey me, because Jesus says the exact same things. If you love him, you will obey his commandments. Now, that doesn't mean you will never sin, and that doesn't mean you'll never need forgiveness. But, you know, when I think about, you know, even just keeping my home and taking care of my children and feeding my husband and things like that, like, there are plenty of times where I think, oh, I don't want to do this third load of laundry today. But I often get that little voice that's like, if you love me, obey my commandments. And part of that is, I'm going to be content with what the Lord has given me. I'm going to serve my family as if I'm serving the Lord, which is also what God tells us to do. I'm going to fold this load of laundry to the glory of God. Like, I'm going to do everything that I'm supposed to do with joy and contentment in my heart. And when I do that, when I have that kind of attitude towards the very mundane home things that sometimes you just get like bogged down in, it changes my whole perspective on everything. It gives me joy. It gives me purpose. So much of what we want to look at with housewives and moms and things like that and say like, oh, well, that's just so like boring and like not worth anything. What? Like, I'm raising disciples in the Lord. You know, every day I have a new opportunity to show them the grace and loving kindness of the Lord. And like, that is no small thing. I'm raising these children to be successful members of society later on, and also to be able to preach the gospel to people later on. And that is no small task. It's something that's got to happen over days and months and years. And I have to have this mindset of like, whether I'm folding laundry, whether I'm doing the dishes, whether I'm cooking a meal, I'm not doing this for the sake of doing it. I'm doing it for the sake of what the Lord has commanded.
Absolutely. I posted something the other day that was like, you know, it's just hard for me to be too like black-pilled, because I know that I'm raising strong servants of the Lord and eventually they will run for office and so everything's going to be okay. And then Tony retweeted it and he was like, my sons will rule you, cry harder, pagans. And I was like, that's
what a king moment,
what a king, but such a like total like just such evidence that of the difference between men and women.
Yes, exactly. And yeah, I mean, like you said, it's hard for me to be black-pilled. There are moments where I like kind of get bogged down and like I look at stuff on Twitter and I'm like, how can this happen? Like, how can the Lord tarry? You know, how much longer do we have on this earth? Like, with all the sin that's going on, I don't know how it can continue on. But at the same time, like, I do think being black-pilled in some sense is sinful, because you know, the Lord has told us in his word that he is victorious, that he has been victorious, that he is victorious, and he will be victorious. And when we kind of get bogged down in those things and thinking like the world is winning, I think that's a sinful mindset of like, we don't have faith that God is going to make everything right. And I have to constantly remind myself that like, one day there's not going to be any grief, there's not going to be any more tears. And I don't know how that will happen, because like I said, I've got a brother who's not, he has not repented. He does not have faith in Christ. I don't know how I'm going to be in the new heaven and in the new earth and not be sad about him not being there should he never repent. But I do know that he has shown that he's faithful to keep his promises, and he's promised to do that. So all I can do is trust in that. And when you trust in the Lord and his faithfulness and his promises, I think that leads you in the total opposite direction of being black-pilled.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's, there is so much to like bog you down with what's going on, because it does seem like the world is winning right now. Like, you look around and it's like, oh my goodness. But I see so much like good, and even like our little corner of Twitter, we've got all these moms who come from like different places, different kind of points of view, but we're all just striving to be like, you know, biblical wives, raise raised, you know, good, strong children in the Lord, and our way of going about that may be a lot different, but that's the common goal in our homes. And even how, you know, a lot of the conversations, of course, there's always like some that get a little heated or whatever, but overall, it's just a bunch of women who are like, hey, this is how I do it. Maybe that'll work, you know, good luck. And even that gives me so much hope, because it's, I just find it so encouraging. It's been such a blessing for me, for sure. You know, and it's, I look around, I think I did not even know what Calvinist meant when I don't think I ever heard that word when I was like growing up. And, you know, just the resurgence of Calvinists in the church, and, you know, the kind of, you know, the wave of post mills. It's like, I don't know. I see hope everywhere, you know, but if you focus on what the world is doing, then yeah, it's going to seem insurmountable, because it is a lot. Don't get me wrong. Like, stuff's not great right now, but there is so much hope, and there's so much hope in the Lord, of course.
So, one of the things that, so every night, me and Brad, I don't know if you've seen my tweet about this, but we've been reading through The Lord of the Rings, and I'll read it out loud to Brad because he's never actually read the books. And if you know anything about me, you know that I love fantasy books. I love to read. He likes reading more nonfiction stuff. But so I was like, you've got to read The Lord of the Rings at least once in your life. So we've been reading through that. And towards the end of The Fellowship of the Ring, they don't show this scene. They show some of it in the movie, but like, you know, when they're on the boats that the elves give them, it's in the first one in Fellowship, where, I don't know if you've seen it. I'm assuming you've seen it. If not, you need to get off here and go watch it. But they're on the river, and they're passing through the Argonauth, which is like these two big statues that are their ancestors of Aragorns that have, it's just like a pathway that they go through the river. And in the book, when they approach the Argonauth, Aragorn looks to these statues, and he looks to these faces of these ancestors of his, and he's from a long line of kingly men. And Frodo is just looking at Aragorn, and Aragorn's like, "Fear not." And he's like, "Fear not." Like, he looks on the faces of his ancestors who were strong kingly men, and like, he's known that in the book, he's much more like kingly. He knows his place. He's the rightful king of Gondor, and he knows he needs to take that up. But like, at this moment specifically, he's looking at these ancestors of his and their faces, and he's like, "Fear not." Like, I want my children and my children's children to be able to look back at the things that we've set in motion for them, and how we've discipled them, and how we've taught them and raised them up, and to be able to think, you know, fear not, like, the Lord is with us. We are from a long line of kings. And you know, that moment, like, I wish they would have put that in the movies, because it's such a cool moment where, like, Frodo has had all this fear and doubt and depression from the ring and everything, and like, thinking like, how can we get past this insurmountable just roadblock, like taking the ring to Mordor? And in this one moment, like, he's looking on Aragorn's face, and he's like, I don't have anything to fear at this point. Like, I know that Aragorn's gonna be king. Like, I know that everything's gonna be right.
Yes, I love that. I want my, just like you said, I want my sons to, well, and my daughters to look around and just know that, like, there's no need for fear. Like, everything is going to be okay. Lauren, do you have any last words about your woke journey back to sanity, or about the SBC, or anything we've talked about today? Because we've just hit the 1 hour mark, so we're probably nearing the end of this. Any last words?
I would just say, you know, like, if you're struggling with, I think a lot of people who are just toe in the water woke, they're struggling with, like, wanting to have empathy for people and wanting to be kind to people. And they see these progressive policies and progressive mindsets as the only alternative to that. And I would just say, you know, like if you're struggling with that and you're struggling with like sometimes the apathy that comes with conservative mindsets, that true empathy is only found in the Lord. And you have to be able to face things that you are not right about. You have to be able to face sin in your life. And you can't have true empathy. You can't have true loving kindness for people if you hate them enough to never share the gospel with them and tell them that they need to repent of their sin. And so, you know, I would just really, I would tell people, you know, go out and tell people about Jesus. Like, you've got to do that. Otherwise it's hateful. You're showing hate to people by not giving them the good news of the gospel, because in the end, you know, Revelation tells us in 20, like, they're going to be thrown in a lake of fire. Their names are going to be blotted out of the book of life. Like, I don't wish that on any person. And I want them to know that there is an alternative, like that God has control over everything, and he is king, and he will be victorious.
Absolutely. I love that. And I totally forgot to ask you this question when we started, but hit me with a recent king moment that your husband has had that just made you realize again, you know, kind of shook you back and made you realize like, oh my goodness, I am married to a total king.
Okay. So I wouldn't necessarily say it's recent, but I guess it's recent-ish, but like when I had my third child, you know, in the beginning of having a baby, you're sleep deprived. You don't sleep well because you're constantly, you hear every rustle and movement that they make and you're like, are they smothering? And you're just constantly like looking over to see if they're okay and alive. So that first, you know, month, 2 months, you're not sleeping very well. And, one thing that Brad did that was like total king move was, around 5 o'clock each morning, which is not how early he normally gets up. He would get up, he would take the baby into the living room and let the baby sleep in the living room. He had like a little, it's like a little Dock-a-Tot thing that he would put him on the couch next to him while he read or drank coffee or something. And he did that. He would do that from like 5 to 8. And so that I could sleep for those next 3 hours, just undisturbed. And you know, that seems like such a small thing, but like that, those were the most peaceful hours of my sleep, knowing that someone else had their eyes on the baby, knowing that he was sacrificing his sleep and time, to get up and do that for me was just really wonderful. And I can remember just living for 5 o'clock. Like, I wake up to nurse at like 3 and think, oh, only 2 more hours so I can sleep peacefully.
What a king. We love a good father king, good husband king. That is the best. You guys, we're going to wrap up for today. And before we go, I will just remind our listeners that all of the thoughts and opinions expressed here belong to the person who spoke them. But as with everything in Patriarchy Country, this episode has been husband approved. So you can direct any and all of your complaints or misgivings straight to the man himself. Tony is at What's Good It's Tea on Twitter, and he joined specifically for this reason. So feel free to direct any of your ire to him, and he will promptly remind you that he runs his house as he sees fit. And Lauren's husband is also on Twitter. He is at Bradford Dorman, and I'm sure that he would love to give you the same message. So thanks everybody for listening. Thank you, Lauren, for being here. And until next time, you
Thank
guys.
You.
Sorry, that was awesome. Hey, this is for the homemakers. Hey, this is for the homemakers. Hey, dancing through a homemaker. Hey, this is for the homemakers. 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 This is for the homemakers.